And now it's very my pleasure to introduce to you guys Miriam from Tennessee. Yeah.
Hi everyone, Mary Gibbs, alcoholic. I'm so grateful to be here. This is my hometown. This is where I got sober. I slaved away for years on the committee. I did backup treatment. I did backup registration for 2 years, registration then for 2 years. I was the treasurer. I did H&I for several years. I was the co-chair of the MARC. I was the chair. I did decorations. And so everybody who puts this on, I know how much work that you've done. And I want to thank you for that. All the people who sit at those tables hour after hour after hour. Make this all possible for the rest of us and the tapers who are here, and just everybody who's done all the work. So I really appreciate that. And it's been really sweet. I cried a lot since I've been here. Just been beautiful to see my family and friends and the people that, you know, most of those old-timers that knew me when I got here have passed on now. But I get to see some of the women I sponsor and then some of the people that I remember when you were brand new and you got here and now you're still here after all these years. And it's such a wonderful and remarkable weekend for me. I didn't plan on speaking. I was coming. I was already in town. And Peggy, a lot of you know Peggy. We're both former chairs and we were going to come out and celebrate the 50th with you. And then she ended up getting, as you know, cancer. And she's just starting her treatment, so she couldn't make it. But she sends her love and she wishes she were here with us this weekend. So anyway, so I'm going to give you my H&I talk. I'm going to talk to you about what I did in H&I. How many of you do H&I? That's why I love SoCal. How many of you got the message through H&I? That's it. And the importance of that. You know, I'm just going to say, how many of you are open door people? There you go. Oh, and I hear the stickers, and I want to tell you, there's a line, it's one of my favorite lines in the book. It says, when we see a man sinking into the mire that is alcoholism, we give him first aid, and we place what we have at his disposal. And on July 12, 1987, the people of the open door knew what I needed. And I know it was the back door when I got sober, and when we moved over to H, we changed it to the open door, and people mockingly call it the open sore. But I'm going to tell you, those are the people that saved my life. You know, that first aid kit that I have at home, it's got a Band-Aid if you cut yourself. It's got a little salve and gauze if you got a burn. And then it's got a tourniquet when you're bleeding out. And when I walked in, the people, the open door, knew how to apply that tourniquet, and they saved my life. So I don't want anybody to mock the open door, because both my husband and I got sober there. My sobriety date, July 12, 1987. I have 36 years. My husband got sober at the open door, and he has 32 years of sobriety. There's plenty of people in this room who got sober in a place like that. And it's where the low bottom drunks went, and that's exactly where I needed to be. My sponsor didn't go there because she liked the bright, shiny rooms, and it was an easy way for me to hang out and avoid her in the beginning. Because it was a one-room brick building, and the walls were brown from the smoke, and we had one air light bulb on there, and you don't dare use the bathroom, but that's where it happened for me. So I'm going to tell you briefly about what got me to AA and the times I was provided the message when I didn't heed it. So I grew up in this town, and, you know, it's not the greatest town, but it was small then, but I found alcohol when I was 11, and I started drinking, and I loved it. It gave me the I don't cares. My brother was class president, my sister was on the homecoming court, and then there's me, and I found the effects produced by alcohol, and I loved it, and at the age of 19, I married my first husband. And we moved to Los Angeles, and everything's about me all the time. And one day he comes home, and he says he's leaving because he's unhappy. Really? I'm pretty happy, because I'm doing what I want, and I want him to do everything I want, too. And so my life is pretty good, but he was felt it was a little demanding. So he left, and, you know, I went to the girls used to go out after work. And I said, can I go? And they said, sure. And they took me to a nightclub. And they were playing Madonna and Chaka Khan. My first concert was Led Zeppelin, 1977, so hitting up on Madonna and Chaka Khan, and I was a little scared, and they gave me a Long Island iced tea, and ate Long Island iced teas later on. Chuck and Helen. Smoking, I love the music, and I love the way it made me feel. But things were beginning to happen in my drinking, and my roommate had, you know, said a couple of things. I said, well, I know I'm drinking a little too much. I'm going to cut back after the Halloween party. But I got arrested on October 30th, 1985, pulling into my garage in Van Nuys. I was living in Van Nuys at the time. And, you know, and it was the greatest thing that happened for me because I got sentenced to 6 AA meetings, hospital therapy, and a restricted license. So it might be my night to drive, but I can't because I'm not restricted, so I give you my key, well, we can take my car. And that allowed me to drink like I wanted to drink. And I went to the hospital therapy group. I don't know if they sent me to this meeting. It was a Saturday night in Van Nuys, and the guy was very funny. He was a Skid Row drunk who got sober, and he became a member of Alcoholics Anonymous and became a lawyer. And he lived in a cardboard box, and I thought, my God, if I lived in a box, I'd go to AA too. So I went back, and I was 24 years old, and I told my friends at treatment or rehab or whatever I was going to, therapy, that if I had to suffer, the guy was funny. And they said, better than that, there's a great bar next door. So I came in, and I put my court card in the basket. I went next door, I ordered a beer, and I played darts. And I didn't hear the message of Alcoholics Anonymous. A year later, I am in jail again. I have another charge. I'm on my 8th warrant from that drunk driving because I cannot make it to court at all. And, you know, that roommate of mine moved out because she said I scared her. And so I just did the only thing I could. I drank. And I drank consistently. And I drank myself out of a job. And I had 50 bags of garbage that I'm picking cigarette butts out of. I don't have any power, so I have an extension cord going over the balcony that plugs in a stereo, a fan, and a lamp. I don't take any showers because I don't have any hot water, and my life is okay. Because instead of my alcoholic life becomes the only normal one I know. And this is what I'm doing. I end up back in jail, and when I get out, I have to beg someone to come get me, and I make it back to my apartment a few days later. And I don't have keys, so I have a ladder. And I get in, and most of my stuff is gone, and I'm yelling in the complex, who stole my stuff? And a neighbor came out and said, Mary, your folks were here. I'm like, oh, God. So I pick up the phone. I don't want to call them. I call my brother and his wife, and my sister-in-law said, well, when they were moving you out, your dad had a heart attack. He's in the hospital. So because my parents break into that apartment, they haven't seen me in ever, and they worry about where I am, and they smell a rotting stench, and they think it's their dead daughter. And what it is the maggots in my refrigerator and freezer from all the food that is now rotted because I don't have any power. And I wait a few days, and I borrow a car, and I come up to see my folks, and I have excuses why I'm living this way. And I go back to that apartment, and about a week later, my folks knock on my door and said, Mary, you need to come up to Lancaster. You can't keep living like this. So I'm like, okay. So I come up to Lancaster. I got my car out of impound, and my parents, I go water skiing. I'm supposed to go water skiing in Pixley, California, if you've ever been there. It's worse than Lancaster, I'll just tell you. But I don't go water skiing. I have my biker boyfriend right up there, and I sit in a bar and drink all weekend. And when I get home, I get in the back of the Jeep, and on the way home, I walk in, and my mom says, you've been lying all along. You have two options today. We're going to get you some help, or you're going to go to the streets of L.A. What do you want to do? I don't even know what to do. I don't have any friends. I'm trying to think about where I could go. And I said, well, I guess I'll go to AA. I mean, I'll go to treatment. And I walked down the hall. It was AD Hospital. They had the Road to Recovery program in there. And there were seven guys sitting in that room. I said, wow. Oh, that's where I'm going. Well, it's those seven men. It's not about getting sober here in Alcoholics Anonymous. And so you people who do H&I, they used to come in 3 or 4 days a week. And I was hoping Vicki would come. Vicki was my very first sponsor. And I just hated her. She was the nicest little thing. And we had book studies like 3 days a week. And she'd go, my name is Vicki. I'm an alcoholic. I'd like to talk about this here. And we'd read the next paragraph. My name is Vicki, I'm an alcoholic, I'd like to talk about the difference. My name is Vicki. And I didn't like her because she was super nice. But you guys planted that seed. And you all gave me your number. And some of you even took me to meetings on the outside once I got out of, I had to do like 10 days in-house, and then I did outpatient, and I stayed with my parents. And they took me once to a book study. It was Chapter to Wives, and they said, "You want to read? You want to share?" And I'm like, "No, I'm not quite an alcoholic. It has nothing to do with me." And they smiled and said, "Keep coming back," because that chapter is very descriptive of who I am when I drink. But I hooked up with one of those 30-day wonders, and I do the treatment center idea of 90 meetings in 90 days. And I went out. He came home one day loaded. And I said, "Baby, if you're going, I'm going." And I went out and I got some tequila. And I spent another 8.5 months out drinking. And it got even worse. So I moved 9 times my last year drinking. People like us are going to move a lot. And I moved back down to Tahunga. And I get a job at my girlfriend's law firm. And what happens is I lie all the time about why I'm not there. And I unplugged my phone from the wall, and they sent the sheriff's department because they think I was murdered. Turns out, you know, I was just drunk out on my couch. And I created a story why I wasn't at the office and what happened to me, because I got bruises, because a girl like me drinks with men like that, and I have bruises all over my arms. And so I'm going to just tell you about my last week of drinking. So I have the good idea to go to Mexico on the 4th of July, 1987, and I know what happens every time I go there. I'm going to drink tequila, and the last thing I know, I come to and I got a black eye, a fat lip, cracked ribs, no panties, parked in the desert, my money's gone. I'm like, oh, Lord. I drive back to the hotel where I don't have a key, but the maid lets me in. My girlfriends are gone, and their luggage is gone. I'm like, well, they couldn't have gone far. So I sleep it off. And they still weren't there, so I laid by the pool until the sun was setting. And then I realized they're not coming, and I got my stuff, and I came across the border, and I called them. And apparently, they had called my family and said I'm crazy. They thought I was on drugs. To my knowledge, I didn't do anything other than alcohol, but that's what happens to me when I drink. So apparently, I got in a fight with them and the federales, and I tried to run them over. And the federales took them to the border, and they caught a Greyhound bus home. I mean, that's what happens when I drink, but my head tells me the next day you can have two, just two. And the next day I'm only going to have two. By the third day I'm like, drinking like it's ginger ale. So July 11th, 1987, is my last drunk. And I'm on a blind date. Let's say I'm on a blind date with Aaron. Lucky you. I'm still sporting a black eye. Can you imagine? I've got the perfect girl for you, Aaron. And I got some. She called a place in Beverly Hills, and I look across the room, and there's Mark, the man I've been waiting for my whole life. And I need my date to go home with another man. And in the middle of doing the nasty, I got a moment of clarity, and I'm like, dude, I gotta go. And he's like, now? I'm like, yeah, wait now. And that wasn't the first time it happened, but it had to be the last time it was gonna happen. Because if you're a woman who lives like that and drinks like that, it's a lonely, sad, empty place to be. And I opened up my wallet and I took up the numbers of those people who do H&I. And I called one of them up. He says, "Why don't you come up here to Lancaster?" I says, "I don't have any gas." He goes, "Mary, you get enough gas to get here, we're going to get you home." And I drive up to Lancaster and he met me at the Sub Machine, 20th Street West and Avenue J. And I walked in there, and he was a big guy with a big belly, and he stood up and he put out his arms like this to me, and I just ran across to him and I started sobbing. And he held me close to his chest and he just let me cry. He said, "Mary, you never have to feel this way again for the rest of your life if you don't want to. One day at a time. I don't know how I'm not going to drink, but I can't keep feeling this way. I can't keep living this way." And my journey in Alcoholics Anonymous started. So I'm about 30 days sober when I went on my first H&I commitment. I'm with this big guy named Jay in a big old red pickup truck. I have nothing to give, but I think I'm all cute. I haven't showered in weeks, you know. I don't look good when I get here. But I'm like, we get in the truck and we're going to a place, and I said, "I don't know anything about staying sober." He goes, "That's right, you don't. You know about relapse. You talked about that." smoking cigarettes and drinking coffee and running my mouth. I knew nothing about staying sober in Alcoholics Anonymous. But I'm doing what they ask me to do. And that's how it all started. And I loved that feeling, and I didn't know what it was when I was new. And I ended up having Vicki as my sponsor. God, Lee, are you kidding me? Because I'm hanging with the boys in sobriety because I got engaged for 3 weeks. And but they're getting direction, and I'm not from the woman I asked. And so I went to an old timer, I'm like, you know, a woman who uses a book, he goes, yeah, honey, here you go, 50. No. So I suffer. And I go to somebody else, you know a woman? Yeah. Here you go, 50. Dang it. So I knew she sponsored everyone. And she said, man, you better come to meetings early and stay late and stick out your hand to people with less time and empty ashtrays, wipe down table, make them pour coffee, and never turn down an AA request. Okay. And that's what happened. And Vicki was very good in H&I. She had like 8 H&I panels. We met behind Claudia's bar, behind the Palmdale group. That was the Palmdale group way back then. And Pat Kelly, she's passed on now, but she was the queen bee of that group. And you didn't get any commitments unless Pat Kelly said you could. And she only let me be a cake lady for 7 years. You can't be on the board, but you make good cake. So just keep that commitment. But she let me have H&I panels. And my first panels that I had were the boys up at Camp Scudder up in Bouquet Canyon. And the miracle of Alcoholics Anonymous began to happen for me. Because for an hour and a half, I thought about somebody other than myself. I thought about those 15, 16, and 17-year-old boys. And sometimes I competed with Monday night football, a pickup basketball game, and a movie. But those 5 boys were sitting that meeting, and it was my job to be there. And I love it when it says, when all other activities fail, intensive work with another alcoholic the same day. I'm pretty newly sober, but I still have and I'm having a bad day. I can smoke in the office at the time, and I call Vicki, and that settles me for a bit, but I get crazy again, and I call a gal I sponsor, and that works for a few minutes, and then that ends, and then I'm like, I call my brother and his wife. I used to stay at their house. They lived out by Bouquet, and I didn't have to do this commute to West L.A. And I said, I'm having a really bad day, so I'm going to do my commitment and go home. I'm going to go to the women's meeting. Monday night, they had a women's meeting at the Open Door. And I said, I'm going to go home. And they said, well, sorry to hear that. And I walked into Camp Scudder, and they said, your panel called, they're not coming. I'm like, oh, great, this just tops my day. But then I had those boys, and so it changed everything, my whole perspective about the day. I stopped thinking about me, and I thought about those boys. And so what happened was I got out of that, and I felt really good. But the next day, I'd be back to my self-centered self. So the only way to get rid of that was to pick up another panel at Camp Sutter. And then I picked up Tehachapi Prison, AV Hospital, Palmdale Hospital, and Active Rehab. And I started through the process of the steps. And I'm pretty certain that I carried the mess more than the message when I was new. But just like Bill Wilson, nobody is getting sober. He's newly sober, and he goes back to Dr. Silkworth. He goes, nobody's staying sober. And Dr. Silkworth said, yes, but you are. And so, you know what? I think that H&I service work saved my life. And it got me out of self long enough to think about somebody else. And then, so I love all the things that I've learned in H&I. I learned about fellowship in H&I. I learned about getting in the car with other people, or you getting into my car. Tragically, you know, I would drive from West L.A., and it would be a 2-hour drive, and I'd pick you up at In-N-Out Burger, and then we had an hour and a half at Tehachapi Prison. And then we have the meeting there, and then an hour and a half back. I'd get home at 10, 11 o'clock at night, and I had to get up at 4 in the morning for my job. But I loved it. It was a set of commitment. And I learned about these other people that they gave me a chance to get to know people outside of the rooms at Alcoholics Anonymous and to develop some friendships with them. And I was newly sober. I didn't like this old-timer, Mr. K, some of you know Mr. K. He was my Sancho, and everybody knows that. And so I didn't like him to get along with his little boys. I thought he was old. He was 52, but I was 26, so he was old. He didn't get along with his boys. And I didn't like him. And I wanted to get, I had a panel up at Tehachapi Prison. I vacillated between minimum and medium, and I wanted a maximum. And you couldn't do maximum unless you had somebody go who has a panel up there, take you up there. And we're at the H&I business meeting. He says, "I'll take her." I'm like, "No, that's all right." He goes, "No, I'll take her." And I had to get in the car and drive that hour and a half up there with Mr. K. And we did the meeting up there in the Max. And then we're driving back. He goes, "We're going for pie and coffee." I'm like, "No, I'm going to go home." "No, we're going to have some pie." And I found out that I really loved Mr. K. When my home group was having trouble and we couldn't get our coffee made on time and we were having some trouble, my sponsor gave me direction and she said, "Invite the old timers." And Mr. K was the only old timer that showed up. He's like, "Where come, you don't have coffee." I go, "Oh, we can't get it done in time. I don't know. I'm tired of fighting." And the next week he shows up with 2 cups of coffee, one for him and one for me. I'm like, "You're brilliant." The rest of us have been complaining for months and he just solves the problem by 2 cups of coffee. So, you know, when you get to meet these people and then the people who carry the message. So one night at Tehachapi, it's on the medium yard, and the storms are raging, and so they don't let the inmates out because there's a lot of trees up there. And so we had a large room, probably 75 people in that room, and there's a guy standing up by the wall at the break of coffee, and I got my coffee, and I went and introduced myself to him, and his name was Richard. And I said, "How's it going? Are you new here?" He goes, "Yeah." He goes, "I normally play on the softball team, but I wanted to, you know, come over here." He goes, "My brother is the biggest knucklehead I know. And he got sober in Alcoholics Anonymous. He got married, he has a baby, and he has a job. And I want to see what you people are about." And I didn't see Richard for like 2 more years. And he came back in and I said, "Hey, I haven't seen you. How's it going?" He goes, "Pretty good. I go, how's your brother doing?" He goes, "Still the biggest knucklehead I know. But he's getting divorced. But he still has a job, and he's still staying sober." And his brother got the message through H&I, and he was a member of the Pacoima group. So the members of the Pacoima group carried that message so beautifully to him, enough that his brother, who's sitting in prison, who was doing a 25-year sentence, would be able to hear the message of Alcoholics Anonymous by watching his own brother and his life that transpired here. So when I moved to Tennessee, we fall outside. AA is so lucky here, and H&I is so lucky, because you go to a business meeting and there's 30 people there and they're all willing to take it, and every group has people and a representative. It wasn't like that in Tennessee. I went to they didn't even have a corrections meeting, and then they had 2 people at the treatment meeting. I'm like, "Well, how do you do this thing? They'll call you, Marion, would you speak? And then I'm going to ask Vanessa, the chair of the meeting." And so they don't have any consistency in their meetings. It's one person this time and one person, and that chairman has to find people for every meeting every month. I said, "Well, this needs to change here. Why wouldn't we have that kind of commitment?" But I learned Tennessee didn't have commitments. My home group now, the one I helped start, the Tennessee group, is the only meeting in town that has commitments. We have greeters, we got coffee people, we got cookie people, we cover all of our services here in AA, and people never had commitments before. And so now, we've started a treatment or a corrections committee. And so, you know, I go to the corrections conference, and I'll be going to the National Corrections Conference in Oklahoma next month and meeting with a bunch of like-minded people who love the service work that we do here in Alcoholics Anonymous. But I was really struggling because meetings are different. They get there a minute before with the key, and they leave a minute after, and I'm calling, my sponsor crying, and then they don't have any corrections. And she's like, "Well, maybe that's why you moved there." "No, it is not why I moved here." And then when the people showed up with the key a minute before and then splitting, and I'm crying to her, and she goes, "Well, what do you think you could do about that?" "I don't know. I know what she's asking me to do, but I don't want to do it." And about 90 days in, I finally got cleared. I go up to Morgan County Correction every Tuesday night. It's a men's prison. And so, you know, at one more night, I get out of my meeting, and I get there 30 minutes before, and I sat in my car for 28 of them until the guy with the key shows up. And I go in, and after the meeting, I come out of the bathroom, and they're all gone except the guy with the key. And for the 30th time, I started to cry. And I hear my sponsor's voice, "What do you think you could do about that?" So I called those people I did the prison with. I said, "Would you like to have dinner tomorrow night before we go up to Morgan County?" And so we've been having dinner every Tuesday night since that day. because there's that fellowship. I drive through 40 minutes to get up to Oak Ridge, Tennessee, and we stop and we have dinner, and then we have another 30-minute drive up to Morgan County. It's a five-hour commitment every Tuesday, and I wouldn't trade up that night for anything. And so when, you know, we've watched these guys, we had three of our guys curl out right before COVID hit, and we all met for lunch, all of us who carried the message up there, and these three gentlemen. And so it was such a remarkable thing to see, and one of them he'd given us all Christmas cards one year, and he has a guy's stick figure behind the wall, you know, behind the bars, and he said, "You are a star in a bright place. We are so fond of you. Thank you for coming every week." And my husband took that card. I couldn't find it. It's because he put it in a frame for me. Because he knows how I feel about those inmates. I love those men. And Billy ended up dying. He had 9 DUIs. They made him an habitual offender and gave him 24 years. But Billy got out and got out of parole, and then he went up to his sister's house in Illinois, and the other sister is sober. And I hadn't heard from Billy in a while. He hadn't posted anything, and I reached out to his sister. She said, "Billy and my sister took fentanyl, and they both died. I found my brother and sister together." Mm-hmm. And he was a guy who never drank it, used anything in his life other than alcohol. Mm-hmm. And so that card even has more special meaning. You never know about the lives that you're going to touch. And Tom is still sober, and he works at a law firm, and my friend Kevin. And before I came, I wasn't gonna go to my home group on Thursday night. I had to get up at 3 a.m. or 2:30 a.m. and you know, I didn't want to do my home group. And my friend Kevin, who got sober in Morgan County Correction, asked if I would come and give him his birthday cake. And I watched this man that, you know, I watched his life blossom. And he's in service to other men, and he celebrated 8 years of sobriety. He got on my yard right before I got cleared to go, and I wouldn't have missed that. And even though I had no sleep before I came into California, I wouldn't have missed it, because he's showing what Alcoholics Anonymous is for him. You know, when we got to Tehachapi Prison, they finally opened the 3-yard, and I know Sheila goes up to Tehachapi, and we used to cover the 1 and 2 yard, and then they opened up the 3-yard, and we have such joy when we do this. And my friend Diana and me and Tony, they said, "Well, we've opened the level 3-yard if you'd like to go." "Yeah, okay." So we shot over to there, and they said, "We have to wear a vest." And I'm thinking, you know, like the handicap vest, the colored little vest. But it wasn't. It was a sticking vest. It's like a bulletproof vest. It covers your crotch. It covers your side. And I'm like, "Really?" He goes, "Yeah, they like to stick people in this yard." And I'm like, "Oh, okay." So the three of us put our vests on, and we go into the yard, and we're waiting for the inmates, and Diane and I are sitting there, and it fits me beautifully, covers all my vital organs, and Diane is half of my size, and it's overlapping her, and she's completely covered, but my friend Tony is like this big. So it only covers here, and it's whole side. And I'm like, "Would you kidding me? He's a sitting duck." And she goes, "Yes, but they could stick us in the neck or our eye. They could take out our eyes." I mean, it's naked, and I'm an alcoholic. She goes, "You could pirate it." I said, "Yes, but I don't think we get many people wanting to join H&I if that be the case." And I never felt threatened when I was on that yard or any other yard, for that matter. And, you know, we don't have a women's prison here in Maryland. There used to be a women's county jail for a short time, and I did do that until they closed that down again. So I've always done the men's prison. And you know, and I just love what's happened in those yards and watching these men. And I learned a powerful lesson. I used to do the 2-yard, and the guys were, and there were lifers on that yard. And so one of the guys was getting ready to step down to the 1-yard. And the 1-yard is when you get a little more leeway and you're going to be making parole. And that guy is one of the guys who's doing a long term in there. He gets up to share, and he talks about the guy who's getting ready to get out. He goes, "Man, I hope you keep with this AA thing, because for life that you can have, it's the impossibility to think about what kind of life you could have being sober." And so the next guy, he said, "Because I think I have it bad." He goes, "You know, I'm not doing that." He goes, "I'm doing 25 to life." He goes, "That's not bad." He goes, "Because Adrian here is doing life without parole." He goes, man, that ain't bad either. He goes, because we got to think about all those brothers on death row because they ain't ever getting that. And I'm watching this man who has hope, who's doing 25 years of a term, that he gives this guy hope because he knows that the guy's life is, you know, he has all kinds of possibilities getting out. And he had hope that one day he was going to get out. You know, when I had Lancaster State Prison, I was the coordinator at Lancaster State Prison from when it opened until I moved. I think Sheila is the coordinator over there now. And I used to do the one yard because I love the one yard. It was at 5 o'clock on a Tuesday. And people would, you know, come in and with me, having me people who were retired. And so we had a young guy named Frankie, and I watched Frankie grow up in front of my eyes. He was a young kid who was in there. And he was so excited because he was going to see his mom, and he hadn't seen any of his family for all those years that he was down. And so he was so excited, and then on the next week I came in, I said, did you see your mom? He goes, no, she didn't make it. I'm like, no? He goes, no. My mom's an alcoholic. He goes, but she promised me she's coming next week. I go, okay. And he said, do you have something I can give to her? So I gave him a big book and some literature. And I said, give this to your mom. Tell her this is what's happening to you. And so Frankie took that literature, and his mom came the next week. She did show up. And she said, he told her, Mom, this is what I'm doing. Maybe it'll help you. And I said, well, how did that go? He goes, well, she didn't say anything. I said, okay. And then one day I come in, and I've been told that one of the other guys, Hispanic guy, Caesar, you know, and I'm just doing it how they call her up. I don't use those words. And Caesar comes up to me, and I call him Caesar Salad. And he's like, he goes, they're moving brown out, black in. I'm like, why? What's happening? And it was a reason for the desert fungus that grows in our soil here, and it affected the blacks where they were at. They were moving them down here. And so I went up to Frankie, who was Hispanic, and I go, you weren't going to say anything? And the young kid starts crying. His little lip is quivering. And I'm like, what's wrong? I go, is it because you're going to be away from your family? He's like, not really. I go, because you're going to prove yourself? He goes, no. I'm like, then what? He goes, I'm going to miss you guys. And he starts crying. We were the only consistent thing in that kid's life. All the years. Every Tuesday, he knew we'd be there. Doesn't matter if it's Christmas, it's snowing, it's raining. Alcoholics and all that would be present in that room with him. So they moved Frankie out. We always wondered where he was in 2 years. Right before I moved to Tennessee, I walk in one Tuesday night, and there's Frankie sitting in that room. He had been in a camp, a fire camp, and you get a lot more freedom in that fire camp. I go, what are you doing here? He said, it's my last year, and I petitioned to come back so I could be here with you guys. So if you don't think we make any kind of impact on somebody's life, we do. And I told Frankie, I said, find the fellowship when you get out. AA does not stop at the gate. AA doesn't stop at the gate. And it's our responsibility to carry that message and then to meet them on the outside exactly where they are. So I'm going to talk about a couple of other 12-step service calls that I've made. There's a couple of them in here that I'm going to talk about. So right before I moved to Tennessee, anybody who knows me here knows that I watch football, professional football. And I'm a Pats fan. I didn't laugh at me now. Couldn't laugh then. You just groaned. And so I'm notorious for picking up the phone when I don't see someone for a while, and I never ask them if they're sober or what's going on in their life. I'll call up, and this girl that she got sober, and she was living in a sober living home in L.A. for 6 months. She went to a meeting down there, and they said, well, if you live in Lancaster, you've got to come to High Desert and look up money, and she'll help you. So she comes to the High Desert Big Group, but she doesn't want any help, and she sits on the curb and smokes, and she won't go out to dinner, and then I don't see her for a while, and I know what that means, because I'm that girl. And so, but I pick up my phone periodically, and I'm like, hey, I just looked at my phone. I haven't seen you in a while. I hope you're okay. Give me a call if you get the chance. I know she's not going to call, right? Because we don't. And about 3 months later, I pick up the phone. I'm like, hey, I just saw your name. I was thinking of you. I hope you're doing well. Just give me a call if you get the chance. And I get the call. And I'm watching Patriot football playoff on January. And she shows up on my phone. And I said, Dana, I got to take this call. And I pick up the phone and she goes, help me. I need you to help me. So get in the shower. I'll come and get you. And she's a full-blown drunk. She's a young woman, 32 years old. Her husband's serving in Afghanistan. Her mom had to take those little puppies because she couldn't take care of those dogs. And I went and got some cold soda, and I picked her up, and I took her out to the Sunday Women's Stag meeting at 4 o'clock in the afternoon. And she is stinking bad. I'm like, did you shower? Mm-hmm. And I'm like, mm. And she's swaying, and I'm just hoping she doesn't puke because, And I gave her a Coca-Cola, and I went, and I said, when was the last time you ate? She goes, I don't know. And I got her some McDonald's, and we went out to the meeting, and we sat there. And I get home after the meeting, and I walk her into the house, and I spend a few minutes with her, and I said, give me your car keys. She goes, you're really smart. I know. And I took those keys. And I said, I'll be back tomorrow. And I went back the next day, and I picked her up, and I brought her some more Coke and another McDonald's bag. And we went to a meeting, and I spent a little more time with her, and I took her home that night. And I secretaried the new 12 to 12 at the Grange on Tuesdays. And I said, I'm going to pick you up tomorrow at 11 o'clock. And I picked her up, and she was starting to look a little better and didn't smell like booze. And we went out to the meeting. I said, now we're going grocery shopping because you need to start eating properly. And I took her grocery shopping, and we got her some soup and some other things. And I get her home, and we carry in the groceries, and I'll help her put them away. And I hand her her keys. And I said, this is up to you now, whatever you choose to do. And I was already in the process of getting ready to move to Tennessee, and you know, we'd already sold our business, and we're waiting to put our house on the market, and so I wasn't going to be able to sponsor her. And so I've watched this woman's life unfold. She's working on her master's degree right now, and she has two little girls, and I just watched this young woman's life bloom. And so during COVID, David and I went down to Biloxi to go gambling, and it's, of course, January, and it's playoff. And it's between games, and we called her up, and we say happy birthday to her. And we just sat chatting for like 20 minutes. And then I said, well, we gotta go. We're gonna have to go get something to eat. And she just starts sobbing. She's like, thank you for picking up the phone. I'm so thankful for picking up the phone. I don't know where I would be. She's crying. I'm crying. My husband's crying. All I had to do was answer the phone. You didn't have to do anything else. I never will side click you. I will never turn my phone off in case you need me, because you did that for me. Those H&I people did that for me the day I called. You were the ones who put the tourniquet on me. And I'm so grateful to watch that. And the next week, my phone rings again in the middle of a playoff game. It's a private number. I know whose number it is. I'm going to have to go. And I met her at a meeting. And though she didn't stay sober, she got in. That was in January. She got sober in June of that year. And I've watched her life blossom. All we have to do is be willing to be of service to those people who are around us, right? And carry that message whenever we can do it. So H&I has been the turning point in my life. It's given me everything. And there's something that I have in my book that I love it, and it's so fitting. Because it says, I slept and I dreamt that life is all joy. I woke and I saw that life is all service. I served and I saw that service is joy. Because isn't that what it is? I'm the most selfish, self-centered person I ever knew. I'm just going to tell you that. You know, because it's always been about me. And having that kind of service has given me a sense of joy and purpose in my life that I didn't know was ever possible. My life and God have always been the chronic malcontent. And when I started doing that H&I, my whole life started to change. And so, you know, my husband, a couple years ago, he said to me, I thought he said, but he didn't. You're the nicest person I've ever known. Yes, my friends were laughing. That's not true. Thank you. ate that in a few days. And I'm like, wow, that's right. And then I start to question that because I know it's not true. So I was really surprised that you said that really lovely compliment about me. And he goes, what compliment? I said, you said I'm the nicest person you know. He goes, that's not what I said. But what did he say? He said, you're the kindest person I know. And there's a difference. A nice person is friendly, amenable. You know, that kind of person. But a kind person, he says, you're willing to give at any time to anybody, no matter how long it takes. You know, when I grew up as a kid, my mother always said, you have 2 minutes left. And my whole life, I felt less than. But the people in AA, especially the people at the Open Door, never did that. My sponsors have never done that. You've always said, how much time do you need? I'll sit with you as long as you need it to be. And so I do that with the women I meet. If you call me, I might have something else that I have to get off the phone. But when we sit down together, I'll give you 20 minutes or 7 hours. Right? None of that changes. It's because we all get to become a part of this. And at the end of Dr. Bob's story, he talks about why he does it. It's a sense of duty. I've always felt it's a sense of duty. Always. And it gives back to the man who carried the message to me. Right? There is nothing more self-centered of me to do than not be able to go out and help somebody else after all of you have helped me. All of those people who carried that message. All of you who showed me your example of what service is. Right? And then it says it takes a slip, you know, prevents a first slip, because when I'm working with you, I'm not thinking about me. And when I get to tell my story or do service work and I get to talk about my last week of drinking, my last month, my last year, it reminds me exactly where I come from and how far my life has changed. I'm just drew a blank. I'm getting old. So if you haven't ever done service work, go to the H&I business meeting here. Second Sunday of the month, still at the Alana Club, is that where it's at?
Friends of Bell Club now,
okay. Yep. They'd be happy to have you. There's always a room to carry the message. And, you know, even if you don't know how to carry the message, they show us how to do that. They showed me how to be of service. They showed me how to be a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. One of many in the world, right? Because I didn't know how to be one of many. I didn't know how to be a friend. I didn't know how to have companionship. And that's why I loved taking the message. And that's why I loved when I had Warm Springs. It's an hour drive up to Warm Springs when Warm Springs was open. And then an hour drive back. I crafted these friendships that will last for a lifetime. Because I'm willing to do service. So in Tennessee, when I moved to Tennessee, we didn't have corrections. And so I joined area. And I joined area. It falls under general service. So it's not a well-oiled machine like Southern California H&I. And I got there, and they go, you should be a chair. You should. I go, I don't know anything about general service because we don't fall under that here. I said, they go, yeah, but you have a lot of experience. I go, yeah, at H&I, but not in general service. I'm not, I would be doing a disservice to the group. I believe that to be true. But I'll take another commitment. And they asked me to start the pre-release program. And we started a pre-release so we could bypass New York. Because we get an inmate was sent to New York, and then New York would transfer it down to our chair. And then that chair would hold it until, you know, our next meeting. And so it's months before the guy gets anything. So we created a pre-release program in the state of Tennessee. And every inmate, every facility we cover gets a form. It would come to me, and then we had a database of members who would be willing to take them to meetings, and that's how Kevin, my friend Kevin, I just gave his cake to, got it. He was paroling to Murfreesboro, and so there were 3 people on that list for Murfreesboro, and they corresponded back and forth. And they met Kevin when he got out of that meeting. So I'd never done that kind of service work, but it broadened my experience here in Alcoholics Anonymous, and then I became the intergroup corrections rep. And I go with our treatment rep, and we go every month to a different district and offer to put on a workshop for them. and provide them literature and become of service to all these groups. And I just was logged on the other night. I did District 6, and we still do it by Zoom. Mm-hmm. But I got to be present for that meeting and see, and they've asked us to do a panel, I mean a workshop on treatment and corrections and carrying the message. You know, I got to be of service. I'm now my alternate GSR. I'm venturing into the GSR realm. So I just started studying the concepts. So I'm fully informed and prepared by the time my term comes up to be able to do that kind of service and to represent my group well and to represent Alcoholics Anonymous. So if you're not in service, I mean, during COVID, I had a really hard time. I had no service commitments. None. Even though most of our meetings were open, where I had certain, the prisons weren't open, treatment wasn't open, my home group wasn't open, but we had a lot of open meetings. I was a trash picker rusher at my home group. I started at the bottom. I was there 5 years before I became the secretary. I was a greeter. I was a trash picker rusher. I started wherever you need me to be, right? Because I learned that service is joy. No matter how long I've been sober, service is joy. And I want to thank you for having me.
All right.
Let's thank our speaker one more time. And thank you all. Thank you so much. Everything for you will now be read by